If you want to hear about the opportunities that we are presenting to our investors, go to BrickinInvestmentGroup.com and join the Brickin Investor Club. We scour for the best opportunities and present those only to folks inside the club, and that is the only way you'll hear about our deals and what we're working on. We'd love for you to be a part. Again, go to BrickinInvestmentGroup.com and join the Brickin Investor Club.
If the point of the Fed, if the point of central banks is to provide us with economic stability to smooth out these booms and busts, well, they're doing a pretty bad job of it because we're pretty early, Sam, in the 21st century. We've already had two.
Welcome to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate Show. Whether you are an active or passive investor, we'll teach you how to scale your real estate investing business into something big.
Jeff Deist is president of the Mises Institute, where he serves as a writer, public speaker, and advocate for property, markets, and civil society. He previously worked as a longtime advisor and chief of staff to Congressman Ron Paul, and in his years with Dr. Paul, he worked with countless grassroots activists and organizations dedicated to reducing the size and scope of government. He's also spent many years as a tax attorney advising private equity clients on mergers and acquisitions. Jeff, welcome to the show.
Hey, good morning, Sam. It's great to see you.
The pleasure is all mine. The pleasure is absolutely all mine. You know, I think one of the things that here as we kick off this week of really just talking about economics, but really from a liberty perspective.
What is the connection between economics and liberty?
Well, I mean, the two are separate in the sense that economics per se doesn't give us any kind of normative value system or political outlook. But for the most part, most people who have read or studied in the Austrian school tend to be on the liberty side of things in their personal politics. So that's understandable, I think. But really, in my view, what the Austrian school is all about is a different way of looking at economics. And really, the way most people looked at economics up until Keynes came along and ruined everything in the 30s. And what I mean by looking at economics, I would stress that first and foremost, it's a social science, which means we're looking at human beings. We're trying to derive precepts from our knowledge and understanding of human beings and what they do. And human beings aren't molecules. Human beings aren't atoms. So when we think of physics, you might observe some phenomena, you might create a hypothesis around that and then go test it to try to falsify it. We strongly argue that economics is not the same. In other words, this idea of scientism, of applying the methods of the physical sciences to the social sciences like economics, has actually been very harmful. I mean, human beings have will, they have volition, they have irrationalities, they have moods, you know, they can do all kinds of crazy things. And so it's really, from a methodological perspective, a different way of thinking about and studying economics. But also, it's a way of understanding causation. You know, why do humans do things and what happens when they do? As opposed to thinking about economics as full of math or full of statistics or full of models that predict things. And what we've seen, especially maybe the last couple of decades with the housing bust and the big crash in 07 and 08, is that it seems to me like time and time again, those models, those statistical ways of looking at humans and trying to shove them into a notion of aggregates doesn't work so well. It's not really serving us. It's not helping us understand the world or making us wealthier or happier or wiser. And that's really what social scientists ought to be doing. So the Austrian school attempts to correct some of these errors. There's a long tradition dating back really to the 1800s of what we might loosely term Austrian economists and their American offspring. So if anybody's interested in learning more, I suggest they do, because if you're in business for yourself, if you're an entrepreneur, if you're in real estate, if you're, let's say, flipping houses, if you're selling houses, whatever it might be, you know, you need to understand at least some baseline economics. I don't think economics is enough, but I think it's certainly necessary.
Right, right. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, and one of the things I want to talk about today is liberty and how it interplays with economics. You know, one of the things I think that the Mises Institute stresses is personal liberty. So what is going on now, and what does that interplay look like?
Well, I think what's going on is one of the worst abdications of responsibility by these political clowns who are supposed to protect our freedom and our property. I think COVID was never the threat it was painted to be, but even if it were, I don't think it justifies the lockdown of businesses and schools and restaurants and churches in any way, shape, or form, especially knowing what we know about the dangers it poses to, let's say, people under 40, which by all measures appears to be about the same as standard flu. So there was never any reason for people under 40 to be changing anything. As a matter of fact, we should have been allowing especially younger people to shine in some of these, you know, in the in-person portions of a lot of businesses and office settings while we maybe protect some of the older folks and let them work from Zoom or whatever at home. So it's a huge missed opportunity. It's going to be an economic scar, which we're going to feel the effects of this a long, long time. And the idea that you can somehow separate the humanitarian or health elements, you know, people dying, from the underlying economic realities is just absolutely false. We know unequivocally that more prosperous societies are healthier and produce better health outcomes, and that poorer societies produce worse health outcomes. I mean, we know this beyond a shadow of a doubt. So when the approach is to locking hundreds of millions of Americans in their home and thereby moving them closer to poverty, the idea that that's going to make us healthier, Sam, was just crazy from the get-go. And we're going to see and feel suicide, depression, undiagnosed illnesses, you know, foregone surgeries, cancer treatments that went undone. We're going to find a lot of people suffering from greater obesity, from greater depression, all kinds of health ramifications on the purely human side. So, you know, I don't take some clinical sterile approach like, well, we just need to worry about GDP. That's not it at all. So personal freedom, I think, is absolutely endangered in this country. And really, it reminds me a lot of the period right after 9/11. And those terrorist attacks, because I don't know about you, Sam, but what I worried about was not so much getting blown up on an airplane or something. What I worried about was what the government response was going to be.
Right,
and
right.
We saw that that was the Patriot Act and other things. So we're in a period a lot like that now.
Yeah, I mean, we're definitely in a period a lot like that now. And a lot of, I think, the things that we're seeing now began before then. But, you know, the Patriot Act kind of set a lot of the precedents for the steps that were taken in the last 12 to 18 months that have just been unbelievable. Is there anything that we can do, you know, as it pertains? I mean, liberty is essential for a sound economy, right? I mean, I believe that to be true.
Absolutely.
Okay. So, I mean, and if you can poke holes in that, please tell me. But if liberty is essential to a sound economy, where do we go from here?
Well, I think first and foremost, this notion that socialism is somehow scientific and that it's inevitable, which are the two ways socialism's been sold to us forever and ever, and that's unfortunately enjoying a resurgence in a lot of people's minds. It just isn't borne out by the facts. And the greatest fact we can offer anybody is a history of the 20th century,
right,
which is still fresh, obviously. And then that the planned centralized economies of the Soviet Union and China and Nazi Germany and otherwise produced nothing but privation and starvation and generally war and killing as well. So, I mean, that's a whole nother topic beyond where we can go today. But look, we know that capital goes where it's attracted. We can look at success stories, or at least economic success stories, places right, like Singapore, to understand this. And I think what we have to ask ourselves is, why is America wealthy? And more importantly, what if it all went away? You and I happen to be born into a pretty golden time in human history and in the West. And we, a lot of people our age, and certainly people younger than us, just tend to imagine that all this material wealth around us somehow gets up every morning and materializes itself. And hey, no matter what policies or programs we implement, there's just going to be a Starbucks everywhere. We're all going to have an unbelievable iPhone, and everything's going to be pretty affordable. And we're going to have these astonishing grocery stores with all the variety. And that just isn't the case. You know, there are certainly plenty of people on Earth alive today who still remember the former Soviet Union, who still remember China after its revolution, who still remember all kinds of privation after World War II. You know, we're starting to lose those folks, but they're around and we ought to listen to them, because economics is really just a word for social cooperation. And I think people getting together cooperatively and engaging in win-win transactions, you know, you go into that restaurant, you'd rather have that Mexican tamale than the $7 it costs you, you know. That is really the antithesis of politics. And what we've seen last few years certainly intensify is this zero-sum game of politics, where someone has to be harmed, somebody has to be vanquished. You know, Biden has to win, those terrible Trump deplorables have to lose. Not only have they lose, they have to be punished. That's the opposite of social cooperation. That's called politics.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I'm curious, why do you think we have all this history so close to us that just shows what the absence of liberty and the absence of freedom produces? We've seen the horrors of socialism. Why does it propagate in our universities? Why is this being taught as, I mean, there's nowhere you can't go, I don't feel anymore, where it's somehow this is the right thing to do, this is the right direction to head. Why is that? Why are we so willing to not see history, just basic history?
Yeah, it's a tough one. I mean, is there literally, perhaps maybe even a genetic component, which some people are sort of wired towards a particular worldview, and some people are maybe folks on the left at least feel like they're wired towards greater empathy, and people on the right, or I don't like to use the term right, but people who, you know, advocate greater personal liberty are more wired towards, you know, business or something like that. I mean, who knows? But we certainly aren't doing ourselves any favors in how we teach kids growing up. And history does repeat itself. I think it's just part of human nature that it's awfully hard to learn, even though, unlike previous generations, our access to information history is virtually free. Right. You're already paying your cell phone bill every month. I mean, you know, the additional time it takes you to look up something that kept happening in World War II is so negligible compared to when your grandparents, you know, actually had to go get a physical book. So that's changed. Information's become cheap and easy, but it hasn't made us much wiser. So, you know, I don't know. I don't have a good answer for why we don't seem to learn and why so many people seem inclined towards what I would consider tyrannical government. But I think we also have to understand that a lot of this is nomenclature. A lot of this is semantics. You know, what you and I would consider freedom would be basically the absence of state coercion. And so we could go out and live our lives pretty much as we wish, as long as we're not hurting anyone. And based on our own talents and abilities and efforts, you know, hopefully we have and the good fortune of being born in America, perhaps we can go out there and hustle and make some money, have a pretty good quality of life. But a lot of people view freedom, political freedom, very much in a positive rights sense. In other words, nobody's free if they have to pay rent and they can't. Nobody's free if they don't have food. No one's free if they don't have free medical care. There's a lot of people who view freedom from that lens, not from a lens of government. And so it's a big country. There's a lot of people. I'm firmly convinced that 330 million people is just too big to operate under one central winner-takes-all government. I think it's a recipe for disaster, and it's a recipe for, I hope not, political war, which sometimes devolves into real war, shooting wars. And it's not working. And maybe, Sam, if there's an upside to this COVID debacle, it's that we got to see a little bit of federalism in action. We got to see a little bit of the idea of different states going different ways and people beginning to think of themselves, hey, maybe I'm a little bit more of a Texan or a Floridian than, you know, and I think that's healthy.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, it has been interesting. You know, I think you were mentioning a country earlier, you know, where capital had moved to. And we see that right now, of course, happening in Texas and Florida. I mean, businesses and people just moving en masse to both of those places where there is, you know, more freedom and more personal liberty to do as you see fit and to allocate resources as it is best in your eyes to do so. I'd love to hear your thoughts on what we're doing with our money. Like, where are we now and what in the world, where do we go from this point?
Yeah, it's a debacle. I'm very, very concerned about that. And I mean that in the sense of I'm fearful for my kids, for example. Mm-hmm. I don't just mean this in some sort of academic sense. You know, in the last 12, 14 months now, since February of 2020, more money has been created than virtually the whole history of the United States. I mean, what we call the M2 money supply, which consists of actual cash currency, both the real stuff that you hold in your hands and use at Walmart, but also the digital, the electronic version that's sitting in your bank account. So all the currency plus all of what we can call ready money, which is basically anything, you know, checking and savings deposits, anything you can write a check on, not that anybody writes checks anymore, but, you know, your checking and savings at a local bank, your money market funds with Vanguard or something like that, your mutual funds with checking privileges. So it's sort of the form of money that's really readily available to people to go spend.
Right.
And I think it's probably the best money measure we have. M2 has gone up 25% since February 2020. Okay. So in a sense, if you're not making 26% or more on whatever sort of investments or holdings you have over the last year, in a certain sense, you're losing money. Yeah, if anybody out there knows how to get 26% on their portfolio, I'm going to give you my email address. Contact me immediately after you listen to the show because I want to be your best friend. I want to take you to dinner.
Right.
You know, and it really is something, this bizarre mentality that, you know, this lack of understanding that more money and credit in society does not in and of itself produce any new goods or services, right? No matter what the Fed does, that doesn't magically make new Honda Accords and new bushels of wheat and new dry cleaning services just magically appear. They're two very different things. So money is not stuff. That's the most important thing, the starting point, I think. And what's one of the big distinctions with the Austrian school and sort of a way of thinking that could really help entrepreneurs and small business people and real estate people is that we used to think about economies in terms of production. You need to make more money than you spend, right? And you accumulate in the form of profits or in the form of being frugal with your paycheck, let's say, in a family situation. And over time, you accumulate some of that. That's capital. And then you can put that capital into something that makes your business or your family more productive and efficient, right? And that's the history, really, on the economic side of civilization itself. And so, you know, that's how you improve societies. That's how you build up wealth and make the West what it became over the last couple of centuries, is through capital accumulation and then pouring that back into more productive ways of doing businesses, of producing goods and services. But what really started a little bit with Marx, but I think more importantly with Keynes, just under 100 years ago in the 30s, was this idea that no, it's not about producing stuff and building up capital and savings. What drives an economy is consumption. And so if you look at almost all monetary and fiscal policy today is driven by this idea that we need to get people to go buy more stuff. And we do that through having lots of money available and having lots of cheap credit, by which I mean interest rates, the cost of borrowing that money is very low. But if you think about it, we already want stuff. I mean, you and I don't need to be stimulated to want more stuff. Everybody wants more stuff, although it's a bit of a hollow pursuit, I think, at the end of the day. Once you have a certain baseline, you know, Western standard of living, which is, of course, wonderful. We're fortunate. But, you know, the question is not whether we want more stuff. The question is whether we're productive enough in our personal or business lives to pay for it.
Right.
Two very different things. And so, yeah, I mean, you might be able, you know, in your personal life to go get somebody to finance a Ferrari for you tomorrow. I don't know. What's a used Ferrari? 150?
I have no idea. Maybe. Yeah.
You know, maybe you could shoehorn yourself into that, or maybe you have 150. No problem. But the point here is that the idea that demand rather than production drives an economy is, A, I would argue a radical one, and B, I would argue a new one and an untested one. And so this is really fundamental. You know, are we going to basically just create money to the end of time and always think that somehow magically the US dollar won't radically or rapidly lose value? Or are we going to at some point sort of take a breather, look at the world we built and say, you know, this isn't working. We need a sounder form of money. And to be fair, I mean, if that sounds alarmist on my part, you know, Jerome Powell, the chairman of the Fed, I mean, he'll tell you flat out, Janet Yellen will tell you flat out, look, these are extraordinary measures. We're taking these measures because of COVID. I mean, they'll tell you that this isn't normal and that someday, yes, we ought to get the Fed's balance sheet or its monetary activities back to a more normal state. But the problem is that normal never comes.
Right.
You know, we're still recovering from the 07, 08 crash. A lot of people in the baby boom generation have never really fully recovered from the loss of their, you know, portfolio.
Right.
In that. And then they got real gun shy about the market and maybe lost out on some of what I would consider fake or paper returns since. So this has real world effect on people. So if the point of the Fed, if the point of central banks is to provide us with economic stability to smooth out these booms and busts, well, they're doing a pretty bad job of it because we're pretty early, Sam, in the 21st century. We've already had two.
Right.
Right? I mean, one enormous crash every 10 years doesn't strike me as stability. So I would really encourage people to go read a little bit about gold. Go read a little bit about sound money and sound currency. Go to Mises.org and type that in. You'll get more than you want probably to read. And just ask yourself, what was the difference between having money backed by something which was not fixed, but pretty finite in gold and pretty hard to pull out of the ground. And the difference between that and what we do today. And just ask yourself the question, is this sustainable? Can this go on? And you don't have to ask it in the abstract. You can ask it in the context of your own personal finances and your family if you have them. You know, this is not academic stuff, folks. I'll recommend a book to people, just what they need, a book called When Money Dies by an English writer named Adam Ferguson. And it is a history and an interesting, engaging one. It's not a dry technical book. It's a very interesting history on hyperinflation, mostly in Weimar era Germany. And boy, oh boy, we don't want that to happen here. And I think, you know, we ought to be cognizant of it. We ought to, you know, we ought to understand certainly that point of history so that we can question these people who want to run our lives.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess there's two thoughts I have on that. One is that I know you said that we're doing a very poor job of managing our money and doing things that make sense. I guess the counterpart to that would be, is it on purpose? Like, is it could it potentially be on purpose to ultimately just make our dollar absolutely worthless?
You know, it's a good question. And I don't think that most people who work at central banks or work at our Fed are have bad intentions or malevolent people. In fact, I suspect most of them are way smarter than me because, you know, they have finance and econ degrees from places like Wharton. And so there are some very smart, sharp people, but they've just, you know, anybody under 40 has just grown up in this environment where the Fed's job is just to basically manage the dollar. I don't think currency ought to be managed. I think it ought to be backed right by something. And so it's just a completely different worldview. And to be fair, I mean, the United States has enjoyed, in my strong opinion, a standard of living beyond what it has produced and deserved
right
for a long, long time, really coming out of the Bretton Woods Agreement, but also especially since the 1970s when we de-linked our dollar from gold entirely and foreigners could no longer exchange their U.S. dollars for actual physical gold. And so there was an advisor to the French President Charles de Gaulle named D'Estaing, and he basically said that this arrangement whereby the United States has in, you know, the world's reserve currency constitutes what he called an exorbitant privilege. And what he meant is that central banks all around the world have to have U.S. dollars to basically settle international transactions. And beyond that, countries and businesses all around the world, for the most part, have had to have U.S. dollars to buy oil.
Right.
Because we had an arrangement with OPEC to price oil in dollars. And so for many, many decades now, the U.S. dollar has been the king and everybody needs some of it. And as a result, that has allowed us to effectively export a lot of inflation to the rest of the world because the world needs our dollars, which means they have a bunch of them, which means that, you know, they have to exchange goods and services with us to get them. So we get stuff, they get printed dollars or electronic dollars, which have no intrinsic worth. So it's a pretty good arrangement for us. And I don't mean to be flip about this. When you can get a pair of flip-flops at Walmart for $5 for your kid, you know, as opposed to $8, that's no joke. You know, that's for a less affluent person. That's been a huge benefit for us. Cheap material stuff. And people who are flipping about materialism irritate me because it's a big part of our humanity. But if it's happening artificially, then we have to worry about the day that that comes to an end. And that could come to an end through energy wars. It could come to an end through real wars. It could come to an end through wars over water. Or it could just come to an end because China and Russia and India and Brazil and these big countries, the so-called BRIC nations, just finally get sick of it and say, why are we subsidizing these Americans who are clearly never going to get their fiscal house in order? Their debt keeps ballooning. Every political Congress comes along and spends way more than it takes in taxes. Frankly, at this point, we shouldn't even be paying taxes. I mean, what's the point? Literally half of what Congress spent in fiscal year 2020 was debt financed. So they spent $6 or $7 trillion. They only brought in about 3.5 in taxes. If they can operate the U.S. federal government on 50% debt, why not 80? Why not 100? Why am I even mucking around? Of course, I'm always late. It's almost April 15th. Why am I even mucking around in TurboTax right now?
Right.
You know, I mean, just deficit finance everything. If what the Fed central bankers are saying is true, that we can basically export our inflation and that there'll always be a demand for U.S. dollars or U.S. Treasury debt, and we don't have to worry about it, even at ultra low interest rates, I mean, what can you get? 1.7 on a 10-year treasury right now? Even at ultra low interest rates, the rest of the world will always want our dollars and always buy our debt. We don't have to worry about this. If that's true, then stop taxing me. I don't think it's true, and I don't think it's sustainable.
No, certainly not true, and I don't think anybody that really wants to argue it would argue that it's sustainable. The only thing I have heard is that the treasury bonds and things like that will continue to sell because we're one of the only countries left in the world where there's still positive yield on those. So people are still buying them.
There's positive nominal yield. I would argue that inflation adjusted, it's negative. But yes, right. Compared to sovereign debt coming out of Europe, that is absolutely true.
Right. But again, how long can that show go on? Until at some point, like you said, the BRIC nations just step up and they go, all right, guys, we're sick of it. The party's over. Like we're done. We're done buying your dollars and you guys can have a good time.
Well, if you think about it, negative interest rates go against every human impulse. They cannot exist in a market. They need to be set. And what I mean by that is that no one would ever forego consumption today to get less in the future. Charging you money to hold dollars is basically, you can look at it as a tax, you can look at it as a warehouse fee, you can look at it as all kinds of things, but it's not interest. I mean, we know this. We know that all things equal, Sam, someone would always prefer their dream house at age 40 to age 90, right?
Sure.
Because life is finite. We're all going to die someday and we could all get hit by a bus tomorrow. So the idea that I would give someone $1,000 today to receive $900 back at some future date is just crazy. Other than if your only other options were to give some to use that $1,000 in some way that you only got $800 back.
Right.
In other words, negative interest rates only make sense if you think, well, at least I'm locking in my loss and I know how bad it's going to be, right? It just goes against what we know about human nature. And what we know about human nature says that interest rates would always be positive, even if they're low. So it's a crazy time, and trying to force people to spend money strikes me as a very sick an anti-human impulse on the part of central bankers and fiscal folks, fiscal leaders in countries. Because again, all of our civilization, all of our wealth, all of our happiness has been bound up with this idea of accumulating capital and becoming more productive over time. And there's something very, very wrong with it. I mean, every generation has saved for a rainy day and hoped that it could leave something to its children and grandchildren so those generations got wealthier. And now we literally have a policy that encourages us to consume that, to leave future generations with less what we might call civilizational capital. Wow, I hate that. I hate the cultural ramifications of that, you know? And they're everywhere. They're really hard to see. But, you know, hey, saving is for chumps. I have to go out, 85-year-old grandmother who could once just maybe get 3, 4, 5% on very simple passbook savings accounts in her old age, now has to go out and have some money advisor and have her chasing yields in the FANG stocks or something just to tread water. That's very, very dangerous. And I think it's really unprecedented that we would say, hey, let's consume the buildup capital of our own lives or even previous generations, because our economy needs demand. That's a fundamentally different way of looking at an economy than mine.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. That's absolutely. Jeff, this has been fascinating. I do appreciate you taking the time to come on today. I want to ask you a few more questions as it pertains to the Mises Institute. Do you have a couple more minutes left for that?
Sure, absolutely.
So there's many liberty-focused groups out there. Why did you choose to be a part of the Mises Institute? And can you tell me a little bit about that?
I don't know if I chose. I think the Mises Institute chose me. You know, we're different in the sense that we really aim at an intelligent lay audience. We don't try to influence public policy. We think that's a dead end. We're not political. We think politics is mostly a dead end. We're trying to reach people like you and Elizabeth, for example, who are just smart, interested people, but who are engaged in some small businesses, who are engaged in real estate, you know, who want to understand the world and the economy better. A lot of the people who like and support us have, you know, maybe $3, 4, 5 million. Very nondescript house. They drive a Ford Taurus. They've been frugal. They have a couple businesses. You know, we don't get money from these billionaire types who, you know, it's just a different approach. And our approach is to say, hey, there's a whole lot of incredible information and literature available to you. We try to make as much of it available free online as possible or at very low cost if you buy the book. And, you know, you can avail yourself of this, you know, at little cost and try to puncture these mainstream narratives that people are being bombarded with. So we're really trying to be an alternative school. We're trying to say no matter what age you are, you need school. You need to keep learning. And whether that's just a tiny fraction of your day, maybe consuming a little bit of our social media, or maybe that's something where you want to, hey, you want to put in the time to read a really dense 900-page book over the course of several months, you know, whatever it might be, anything in between those two, we want to be there as a resource and at an alternative school because, you know, school is not working right now in terms of how it's teaching econ to our high school and college folks. That's what we hope we are to people, with just an alternative school.
Got it. No, and that's absolutely true. And I would say every experience I've had with you guys meets all of those criteria for sure. So yeah, certainly appreciate that. The Mises Institute is giving away free printed copies of Henry Hazlitt's Economics in One Lessons. Why did you choose this book and how can our listeners get a copy?
Oh, yes. Well, I consider it the best economics book ever written for lay people, probably. Very short. Just a little less than 200 pages, written by an unbelievably skillful journalist rather than an academic. And his pugnacious writing style really shines through in that book. It's got standalone chapters that you can read without even reading the rest of the book on things like minimum wage or rent control or tariffs that are just devastating to the arguments that our interventionist friends make. So it's beautiful in that sense that if somebody gets this, they can give it to their families and friends. You can just go to Mises.org/one lesson or just go to Mises.org and search it, but Mises.org/one lesson, we'll send you a box of them. So it's really a fantastic primer or introduction. It's a devastating book. It's short. It's easy. And, you know, you want to talk about the difference in America between now and the 1940s when that book came out. It was actually serialized. They changed the form a little bit, but it was actually serialized, Sam, in Reader's Digest.
Oh, wow.
In the 1940s. Imagine that today. You know, it just shows you that we don't have the same attention span and ability to read that we once did, that, you know, that people consider even a short, summary, superficial 175-page book on a punchy book on economics is somehow too much. Well, it isn't too much. You can handle it. You should handle it. And we'd love to send you a box.
And even to think that it was published in Reader's Digest. I mean, you couldn't find that sort of thoughtful content in Reader's Digest to save your life today. So
yeah.
That's absolutely awesome. Jeff, I want to say thanks again for coming on. This was fantastic. I enjoyed every minute of it. As always, good to see you. Again, thanks so much.
All right. Thank you, Sam.
Hey, thanks for listening to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate podcast. If you can do me a favor and subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, whatever platform it is you use to listen. If you can do that for us, that would be a fantastic help to the show. It helps us both attract new listeners as well as rank higher on those directories. So appreciate you listening. Thanks so much and hope to catch you on the next episode.